Well, hello there, good people of the From Inside the Hive podcast. I'm so pleased to have you here. You've joined us today for a conversation. So it's not just me and my thoughts this time. I've got a wonderful guest, and gosh, is she a fabulous guest. I am so pleased that she said yes when I invited her on. And you're about to hear all about the wisdom of writing. So if you are someone who considers themselves or would like to consider themselves a writer or a creative, this one is for you. So without further ado, I'll hand you over to the conversation. Enjoy. Hello, hello, and welcome to From Inside the Hive with me, Jane Galloway from Quiet the Hive. It's really exciting when you meet new people, and sometimes a good way to do that is to go on courses and programs. And some of my listeners will know that I did a program with Sarah Dalrymple recently and met a couple of fantastic people through that. And one of my guests today is a person I met through Sarah. So this amazing woman has written 6 books to date, as well as getting to the heady heights of being deputy head and writing 3 of those books for early careers teachers. She has made the brave choice and an incredibly good choice to step away and concentrate on her writing as her career. Not only is she an author, but she is also a writing coach, and she will help people to develop their writing as well, which I think is wonderful. And the thing that really draws me towards her, obviously, is she is also a self-confessed stationery fan. It is the wonderful Steph Caswell. Steph, hi, how are you?
I'm so well, Jane. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here and to talk to your audience and to you about all the things we're going to chat about in the next few minutes.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. I'm so glad that you're here because as some listeners will know, if you follow me on social media, I'm in the deep, dark throes of writing my book proposal at the moment. And actually, I've been listening to Steph's amazing podcast. And anyone who's thinking about or interested in the process of authorship and publication should really listen to that podcast. And we'll make sure all the links are in the show notes. But before, I should really stop enthusing about you, Steph, and allow you to enthuse about yourself. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what lights you up.
Well, I mean, I love the fact that you said to me to enthuse myself, so I will do that. So I, as you said in your intro, started out my life as a teacher, a primary school teacher, and then I moved into doing what I'm doing now, which is a writing coach, a book coach. There are several labels. I will settle on one at some point, I'm sure. I'm a writing coach, mainly working with business owners, female business owners, because that's where my passion really is. To develop their book ideas, to decide exactly what their book's going to be about, and how it can reach the most readers. And I take them through the process really from their initial idea all the way through the planning and the outlining stages and the writing of the first draft, and get it so that they're ready to send it off to her professional editor, who will then sort of do the work. So because majority of my authors are self-published, I do have a few that are going down the traditional route, but mainly I support those people who are looking to do it themselves. And I absolutely love it. There's nothing more I enjoy than meeting an author and finding out their idea and just seeing it come from a tiny scene right the way through to finished book. So yeah, it's such an honor to do that with people.
There are some times when I wish that I did use the video, because we're obviously recording this over Zoom, and I wish people could see, and they can hear it in your voice, Steph, but the way your face lights up when you talk about what you do just shows me that you are absolutely in the right space. And I love that you talk about how you work with and mentor, particularly female entrepreneurs and small business owners, to approach this really, I think it's an incredibly daunting, scary, exciting, brave, energizing choice to tell their story or share their skills and expertise through a book. But you talk about how you help them do that with confidence and joy. Mm-hmm. And I'd really love to know a little bit more about why that feels like something so important when you're going through the process of not only writing a book, but I suppose creativity more generally. So if we broadened it out, because there will be people listening who think, book, my gosh, no, thank you very much. That doesn't appeal. But my creative passion is this. So why is doing that with confidence and joy so important to you?
That's a really good question. I think that often, and I'm going to speak for women because I generally, as I say, work with women, but also talk to a lot of female entrepreneurs. Yeah. And confidence is a thing when it comes to writing a book. And as you say, at being creative in general, putting yourself out there, fearing what other people might think. Are they going to think, why are you writing a book? You know, what have you got to say? And all these limiting beliefs that crop up sometimes from way back in school days where maybe teachers made an off-the-cuff comment that stuck with somebody and it's 20 years later and they still can't shake it. Yeah. So I definitely feel there's a confidence piece for women in particular around their message and whether they are, why should they be seen as an expert? Who's going to listen to my story? And I feel really strongly that we all have important messages and stories we're trying to tell as business owners. And a book is a really great way to do that. However, often it's that, who am I to say that? Who should be listening to me when it comes to things like a book? Because we read books by our favorite authors. We read books that inspire us and motivate us and challenge us. And we often get that, you know, imposter syndrome of, well, I can't be possibly like such and such author that you admire. Yeah. And it's really hard for people sometimes to shift that feeling of comparing themselves. And I always say to people, the problem is when it comes to writing is you have an idea and you're comparing yourself to somebody's 56th draft that has been polished by an editor, it's in a bookshop, and you're seeing the very final product that has been edited to within an inch of its life, and you're there with just an idea and you can't see the process from that initial idea to that beautifully polished book, because it, like you said, it's so overwhelming and daunting at times to think, well, how am I going to package everything up I want to say into something that's going to sound like my favorite author or somebody I admire? So for me, it's the confidence piece around, yes, your story is important. Yes, what you're trying to do is important to help people, because for somebody, you are that inspiration. And we often forget that. We often forget that.
Oh my gosh. Just in that little bit, Steph, there is so much stuff in there. So firstly, absolutely, the majority of the people you're speaking to now through this podcast are women. Mm-hmm. The number one thing that comes up time and time again is absolutely confidence. And the talk that I'm requested to do most often is inner critic and imposter syndrome. So absolutely that resonates. There is something, so I recorded a podcast episode with the wonderful Lucy Werner, who is all about hyping yourself. She's a PR expert. She's just fantastic. And in her podcast with me, she was talking about how actually she really doubted her ability as a writer because of what she was told at school. And, you know, we quite often, it's really funny how a throwaway remark from a teacher sits with us for 15, 20, 30, 35 years and stops us doing something we really love because one person once happened to mention they didn't like the way we did it. And it's not you can't do it. It's just that the feedback from them is they don't like your version of that thing, but it sticks with us and it really hammers into our confidence. So to hear you talk about that, and I had never thought about that concept of when you're picking up the book that you love, and you know, a lot of us will be inspired to write because of things we've read, of authors we love, whether that's fiction, nonfiction, whatever genre, we forget. Of course, that they will have been through the Anne Lamott quote of the shitty first draft, which I know you talk about on your podcast and is something that I use to help people get over procrastination, is to just give yourself permission. We forget that what we're reading is not their shitty first draft. What we're reading is their polished final thing. So comparing your little tiny buzz of an idea with a fully fledged, edited, professionally put out there product is really doing yourself a disservice. I've not even thought about that before. That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's easy to do, right? Because we often, as entrepreneurs, we're people who are, you know, we love reading, we love learning, we want to, you know, give ourselves all the possible tools we might need to be successful. And often that comes through a lot of reading. And we do forget that. We do forget that there are, particularly when they are traditionally published books, there's a massive team that have edited it and proofread it and gone over it again for sense checking and all these things that, you know, when we're starting out, we can't even fathom as a part of the process. But it's the editing really is where the magic happens. You know, that your first draft is shitty because it's supposed to be. It's, you know, Terry Pratchett talks about, you know, writing a novel, the first draft is telling yourself the story. And I always think that about nonfiction first drafts, it's you telling yourself your book. You know, you have to get to know it. You have to see it as a sort of a team effort between you and your book. And you're like, okay, we're getting to know each other a bit now. Like, okay. And you find out stuff about yourself as a writer. You really refine your message through that first draft process. No one is going to see it if you don't want them to. I don't think I show anybody my first draft, you know, not even as a kind of, oh, this is what I've got so far. I just think, oh, right, okay, now I've got something. I take a couple of weeks away and then I come back. I'm like, right, let's see what we can do with this. Let's see how we can polish this. But unless you have something there, you cannot polish it.
I love that. And there is that sense of finding through writing, whether it's writing for publication, writing for joy, whether it's maybe drawing or artistry rather than using words, there is something about beginning to know yourself and finding your voice through that process, which can also unlock so much more than you realize, I think, at the beginning of the process.
Yeah. And that you have to get to know who you are as a creative person, because who you think you might be is often not the person that comes out the other end of the process. And I always think that about writing, about art or anything like that, where when, you know, I was, like you said, the teacher's remark, I remember I was reliably informed that I should not do art GCSE by my art teacher. And even now, even through my teaching career, I used to say to the children, which now looking back, I just want to bang my head against the wall. But I used to say to my class, oh, you see, I'm not very good at art. So I used to just draw stick people. And at the time I was teaching year one, and they used to always applaud whatever I did. So yeah, it was always a little boost of, oh, some 5-year-olds think my stick person is remarkable. But it was a story I told myself. And like, as we know, with creation, you know, being creative and anything in life, the stories we tell ourselves, the narrative we say over and over again is what we believe. And I believe that I wasn't very good at art. And even now, I will rarely pick up a pencil. I want to, but there's just something there. And if I did, I think I'd learn a lot about myself as an artist and what I can and can't do, what I want to do more of, what I want to do less of. But I just don't even take that step, which, you know, when you're looking at it logically, sounds ludicrous, because I know why I'm not doing it and I know all the reasoning. But actually, when it comes to sitting down, we can still really hold back because of those thoughts.
Totally. It's so funny, isn't it? And I have a similar thing with art. So my art teacher, and I've told this story on the podcast before, my art teacher, I decided I was never very good at art, and I decided that I was going to sit down, really put effort in. And I did this drawing and I took it in, and he gave me a 1 out of 10 because he said I traced the drawing. And I hadn't. That was me putting all my effort in. And so from that point, the story I told myself was, I am no good at art. There's no point even trying. And I go every summer, I go with my kids to this amazing festival in West Wales called Gather. It's hosted by a wonderful place called Forest. And you do all sorts of crafty things. And it's brilliant because it's just go and give it a go. And there's everything from blacksmithing to artistry to potion making, all sorts of things. And I make myself do at least one of the art classes. And every single time I've produced something that I have loved. And I've got actually a painting in my office, which I keep meaning to go and get framed, which I did and I love, and it's quite good. And it's really funny, isn't it? But still I look at it and think, oh, well, I couldn't hang it up or anything.
Yeah.
But it's really, really funny how much that sticks to you, with you. So getting beyond that to create art in whatever form that is, and particularly we're talking about the written word, is, I think, so deeply impactful to be able to do that and be brave and step into it. Because like you say, you don't have to show it to anyone. It can be just for you and just for pleasure and joy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think actually sometimes just writing for pleasure is part of that process, just doing something that you wouldn't normally do. I often say to authors, you know, just write something that you would never think of writing. Write a poem, you know, write a short story, write a character profile for a character in a book that, you know, maybe you've read and you want to unpack them a bit more as a character, or just make up a character that you met in the shop and you want to just try it out, because all writing is progress. You know, I've written several children's novels, two of which have never seen the light of day. And people often say to me, how, I mean, isn't that just really unfulfilling? And I said, no, because every draft, every book I've done is just a lesson in getting better at resilience, at practicing the craft, because you can't show up and expect to knock out a bestseller just because you happen to sit down at the laptop one day. It all comes down to practice and, you know, just showing up for yourself and trying things out and seeing what works, seeing what doesn't work. And only through that process do we then find the stuff that works and the stuff that, you know, resonates with people, be it in, you know, as you say, in writing or in any other form of creativity.
Yeah, absolutely. There's something so, I don't know, so freeing and liberating about just giving something a go and not worrying about what's at the other end. Steph, you talked a bit about your, you sort of alluded to your background as a teacher there and how you've written some children's books and just knocking out of children's book and leaving it in a drawer. That's the other thing Beth Kempton said as well, was nothing you write is ever wasted. Because either you use it again or it teaches you something, which absolutely. Is absolutely, I think, what you're saying there, which is really interesting, I think. But tell us about your journey from teaching through to writing. And I know that lots of people who listen to this podcast do so because they're drawn to the idea of people who do something inspiring or who change direction or make that brave choice. And I think to leave one career and go into another and to actually make that step can be really daunting for some people. So I think it's always really interesting to hear about your journey sort of from that to that. So how did you do that?
Yes, well, through a lot of pain, actually, if I'm honest with you. And I'm one of these people that I will struggle to make that step unless I am at the absolute end of my tether with anything. And the way I sort of, you know, I'd gone through being a primary school teacher, I'd worked my way up the leadership scale, I'd become a deputy of a brilliant school locally with a brilliant head teacher, who I'm still very good friends with now. And, you know, we worked together to bring that school from, I think they still use labels like this, but from requires improvement to good, which was a big step for the school. And we'd inherited a lot of bad practice. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the stuff that needed to change had just been sort of left to sort of just got on with because the previous head had retired and he just had lost that sort of inclination for change. So we had a very tough job to turn the school around, and we did. And we were both really, really proud of that. And I still am really proud of that. But along with that comes an enormous amount of stress. And I found that I'm somebody that I would say a high functioning anxious person. So I can seem to be fine. You know, I can be just going along with it. But underneath, you know, there's that whole idea of the duck, you know, gliding along quite effortlessly on the surface, but underneath paddling frantically away. And I think over time, I just started to realize that I didn't actually love what I was doing. I loved where I worked and I loved the people I worked with. But it was the actual job itself, which was causing me to just ever so slowly lose my mental health. And so I kept putting it off and kept putting it off. And part of my job was as a safeguarding team. And we had a lot of intense, difficult meetings and conversations with parents and with other professionals for children. And some of the things that were happening were hard going in terms of the content of what was, you know, happening to these children. And we were in a meeting, and it was with a parent who was an addict, and there was a conversation around the child might be taken away. She unfortunately chose me as her sort of someone to sort of target as to be most displeased with them. And it was a meeting where I was, you know, shouted and screamed at quite a lot. And I came out of that meeting, and it was like, often they say, don't they, it's the straw that breaks the camel's back. And actually, it wasn't that meeting that caused me to decide that I was going to leave teaching, but it was everything. And then that meeting, and I came out of it and I could not stop crying. I could not get over this event. And I could, you know, could still picture it really clearly today. And I came out of it, and whereas before I might have had a little cry and been like, oh, it's okay, I'll feel better next week, I'll feel better. I could not stop crying. I could not stop crying in the night. The thought of going back to school was just awful. So I went to the doctor and got signed off. And I, it's when I was signed off that I started to really think about what I wanted out of my life, because I thought I refuse to be medicated to do my job, which was essentially what the doctor had said. He was like, here's some, you know, anti-anxiety medication. You know, if you take these, and, you know, I did start to feel better. But I thought, what is life if I'm going into a job that's causing me to have to be medicated to do it? So I sat for a long time with this thought, and I'd done so much personal development work. So I knew, you know, that actually life is, you get one chance, you know, you've got to do these things that make you happy ultimately. Yeah. And my husband's a teacher too. So, you know, we were having this conversation back and forth, and I just said to him, I was like, I'm not prepared to do that. I'm not prepared to have to then be on medication for the rest of my career in order to feel like I've got some sort of control. And I made that decision, and I had to tell my wonderful, wonderful head teacher, who is now also no longer a head teacher. She's also left. And, you know, it was a very hard conversation, and we're very lucky. We live with my folks. And so we didn't have the financial constraints of a mortgage. We, you know, we pay them rent, but there wasn't that, oh my gosh, if I stop teaching and stop earning this salary, that everything's going to go to shit. And, you know, I had two young boys at the time, and I thought to myself, you know, I've got to do something for them. I've got to do something that shows them that you need to choose things in life that make you happy. So I left. I did tuition for a while. I did tutoring locally, and I, you know, and I enjoyed it. But again, I was like, oh, it's just something that's just not, it's just missing for me. Like, I love working with kids. They're hilarious. You know, they're brilliant, brilliant people to work with, but I just still felt like I was missing something. And during my deputy headship, I'd written three books, and I thought to myself, what do I love? If you know, it's that age old question, if you could map out your day to be doing whatever you wanted to do, what would I be doing? And I thought, I know, it's writing. Like, I knew it without even blinking, without taking a breath. And I thought to myself, I've got to do something where I'm writing. And I gradually sort of built up this side of the business, and I do write for other people. So, you know, I do some copywriting for people. So I use my skills in that way, but actually my pure joy is helping people to write books and writing books myself. So, you know, I'm getting closer to where I want to be, ultimately, which is just writing books and supporting authors. I'm about 50% there. So I still do some copywriting to sort of, you know, pay the bills on a more consistent basis. But it is one of those things that it means that every day I get to wake up and I get to write in some capacity, and I get to work with amazing people. So that is... Cool. I know you asked for it in a nutshell, and I just almost started a Netflix documentary, but there
it is.
It's
a perfect size shell to describe it in. And that concept, so I'd not, you're opening my mind, Steph, in so many different ways. I'd not thought about that before. Being medicated to do your job, that's just, like, when you put it like that, it's so bloody stark, isn't it? Yeah. And my previous background is working in the NHS, and I know that the public sector, whether that's teaching, whether that's policing, whether that's healthcare, is absolutely battered and full of incredible people who are doing vocational work, who are undervalued, underappreciated, overworked. And that, you know, that concept of it's not that meeting, that wasn't the thing. That was the tipping point. That wasn't the thing. It's lots of little things adding up to it. And that ability to step back and saying, I refuse to be medicated to do a job, is just so right. And, you know, that thing about, okay, what is it? If I could do anything, what would I do? And why am I not doing that? It's so valuable. And it doesn't mean that you have to. So I've been working with a woman recently on one of my programs. She had this big idea, this big dream she wanted to pursue, and she hadn't, because it just felt overwhelming. And she suddenly realized, oh, I don't have to do it all straight away. I can just do a little bit of it. So her dream was to go and move to the country. She'd been living in London for years and years and years and years and years. And she came up with this idea of, I'm going to book an Airbnb in the country for 2 weeks during times that are just normal. And I'm going to do my commute, and I'm going to work, and I'm going to do the domestic stuff. And I'm just going to test it out. And she said it was so funny, because it was like this weight was lifted off her shoulders. So, you know, you can move towards the thing you want to do without having to have this extreme epiphany that comes from the straw that broke the camel's back, but it's spotting that and being brave enough to pursue it, I think. And the fact that you asked yourself that question and refused to put yourself in that position is just so inspiring, I think, Steph. It's just
thank you.
Incredible. Absolutely. Incredible.
But you're right.
You're doing the thing you love.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think people often forget that it's not a, next month I'm just going to be doing something else. It really isn't. And like I said, I started tutoring because I thought, well, I need to do something, A, to bring some money in, because as you can imagine, leaving a deputy head salary and going to zero is difficult. And so I did something that I thought, you know what, I know I can tutor because I know I can teach. So I thought, let me start there. And while I'm built, you know, while I'm doing something that is, you know, for want of a better word, a bit of a busman's holiday, I can then start looking at what else I can be doing and building up this other side of it. And you know, I think sometimes people feel like when you take the leap from a career you've done to something that is unknown, it's terribly overwhelming and scary. But actually, if you plan it out in a way, like you say, where you're doing it in incremental steps, then you can make that actual final step to then doing it all the time is sort of, you just feel like, I'm ready now. Like I was with tutoring, I thought, you know what, I'm in a place now where I don't need to do this anymore. I don't want to do it anymore. But it wasn't like all of a sudden I just stepped into writing, or I just stepped in, because unless you do those bits that maybe some people do while they're still working full time. I know people do that. They build their side hustle, for want of a better word, on the side, to then make that transition less like, you know, you're going to shit your pants.
Yes, which, to put it,
yeah, because it feels like that. You feel like, oh my gosh, if this goes, and one of my friends said to me, and I'll never forget, which it actually prompted me just to go for it, was when she said, Steph, you have a qualification, you are a teacher. She said, if the shit hits the fan, just go and do some supply work. And I was like, oh yeah, that's a good point, because actually if it came to it and I absolutely, you know, it was like nothing was working and I was desperate, then just to sort of tide us over financially, of course I would have gone and joined a supply agency. But the fact is, I never had to do that, because it never got to that point. If it had, I would have done it. I always say now to my husband, you know, God, if everything just went tits up, I'd go and work in a bookshop, because you know, I do something. There's always a solution. And I think we sometimes forget that it might not be the solution we want all the time, but for, you know, for periods of time, it might just be what's needed.
Yeah, absolutely. I talk about it on my programs, is the so what. So the thing that stops us, the fear, I can't possibly do that because what if it all goes wrong and I can't pay my bills? Okay, well, so what? Think beyond that. If it did all go wrong and you can't pay your bills, what would you do? Oh, well, I'd probably do this. Okay, so this fear then becomes a little bit less scary. And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because quite often the thing we worry about, the thing that we put in the way of taking that brave choice, never comes to fruition anyway. It's never the thing that stops us. There may be other things, but it's rarely the thing we think it's going to be.
Tim Ferriss talks about that, actually. His TED talk was around fear setting. And he was saying that every year when he's thinking about the things he wants to achieve, he also spends time talking about if the worst was going to happen. So if I do this, and what's the worst that could happen? And then he always says, like, I put down what the worst is, and then I make a plan for if the worst happens. And then he said, then I've got that buffer between taking that leap or making that decision. And you know, then you're not stepping into the unknown, because you've got a plan and you can step and be like, there's a little net there if, you know, if this doesn't go well. And like you said, it's, yeah, it's so unlikely that it will just completely fall apart. It might not be exactly what you think it is straight away, but you've got something in place then.
Yeah. And you said right at the beginning around how, you know, when we were talking about the stories we tell ourselves, our brain is incredible, but also slightly gullible, and it will believe what you tell it. So that thing about saying, okay, if this issue happens, here's my solution. Your brain kind of goes, oh, right, okay, well, that's that problem dealt with. It's no longer a risk, so I can put it to one side. And it's really interesting. It's such a simple step, but it can really help you when you're trying to make that brave step, I think. It's just amazing. Amazing. Steph, let's get back onto the books. Tell me a little bit about who can write a book.
I often get asked about, can anybody write a book? And I would say to that, I often think, get carefully about this. And I think, yes, they can. Yeah. Whether they write it completely themselves is a different answer, because I think if you have an idea for a book, but you know that you don't, maybe you just don't want to, you don't want to write it, but you think actually it's good. I really want to get my message out there, but I have absolutely no inclination to write it. There are ghostwriters out there. There are people out there who can work with you to make your book what you want it to be. But in terms of people who can write a book, if you're somebody who, say, for example, you think actually writing, it freaks me out. I say to them, then you can dictate your book, you know, just dictate what you want to say. And then you've got something down on paper that you can start to work with. And I was really, really pleased to hear Jamie Oliver talking about this recently around his latest book and how he dictated it. And he said, I dictate all my books because I'm dyslexic and I can't write. So he dictates them and they get done. And then obviously he's got a team that pull them together. But I do think, you know, if you are somebody maybe who has kind of that sort of neurodiverse need, or you've got something that is stopping you, is a barrier, but you actually want to write, there are so many options now, obviously with all this, the AI stuff that's out there that can support you to be able to even just get your initial draft down. I really think that actually there's never been a better time if you are interested in writing a book to be a writer, because there's so many options. Whereas before you had to be, you know, able to write completely by yourself. You know, if you're thinking a couple of hundred years ago, it was all just you and the page. And now it doesn't have to be that way. So, you know, I'm going to say it, anybody can write a book, but how that book comes about is a personal journey and is a personal thing.
Yeah, for sure. And I know you run programs to help people do that.
Yeah.
Do you find, so one of it, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you've got group programs as well as individual one-to-one. Yeah. So do you find that working with people as a group is really helpful, because you get that additional support? People are going through the same thing at the same time in terms of banging their head against the wall or suddenly being inspired or whatever it might be. Do you find that writing together, that group aspect, can be helpful?
Yeah, I think so. There's always a reservation that people worry that, oh, someone's going to steal my ideas, or, you know, or again, it's like, do I feel comfortable talking about what I want to say? Are people going to judge me? All that sort of thing. But I think it's around the vibe that you create within the group, for sure. But I think that the real plus part of being in a group is the fact that you can, there's that accountability, there's that camaraderie that comes with being in a group program, and people are genuinely happy for each other and, you know, geeing each other along, because it's a lonely process writing. You know, ultimately, once you've done all the talking with people, you have to get your bum in the chair and either write it or dictate it or whichever method you're using. But you can't shy away from the fact that you will at some point need to put down your thoughts on paper.
Talk about it, but you have to actually do it, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And I think I read something the other day on LinkedIn where someone said people often like the idea of a book, but the actual doing it is a different thing, because it's the idea of your book on a shelf that's very appealing. Yeah. But when it comes to writing it, it's actually, you know, marginally less so at times. Because you know it's you and you, it's just you and the screen. And so I think the group aspect works because it brings people along together on a journey. They're all in a similar place, they've all got similar ambitions, and ultimately they just want the best for each person. So I think it works really well.
Tell us a bit about your my mind is flitting all over the place. So I had a conversation with someone yesterday who has recently set out on their own to do their own business and has written two books and was showing me their books, and I was thinking, oh my god, I've got real book envy. And she said, but you know the best thing, she said, this book, and she held up this book and she said, this is the best book my publisher says he's never seen. And she got the cover and it was just a blank book inside, so she had this prop. She's like, I'm still writing it, I haven't done it yet. And it's kind of, it's interesting, isn't it, how the tricks your brain can play on you to make you do that thing. So for her, having that there and thinking, oh my god, I've got to fill the pages, that's the motivator. For me, seeing her hold that up and thinking, I want to be where she is, that's the motivator. So finding the thing that's going to motivate you, whether that's with a group or whether that's on your own or whether that's working out what your purpose is and reminding yourself why you're writing the book in the first place, so that when the hard times come and when you get stuck or when you just I've heard you talk about, I love how you keep a record of the number of words you've written as a motivator. I started writing something yesterday and I thought, oh, damn it, I didn't write down what number I was on. I could have done the step thing. So you are in my mind as I'm writing. But something about finding your motivator as well. And sometimes knowing what your purpose is in all sorts of things, not just writing, but sometimes knowing what that deep held purpose is, that can be the thing that on the tough days can spur you forward. And I was wondering what are some of the, so I've given away one of yours, but what are the things you use to motivate yourself to write when you're struggling a bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, the spreadsheet is, I mean, for a writer to enjoy a spreadsheet is very uncommon. I will say that right now. But I used to write it. I used to write my word count on a big wall planner that I had when I used this space that I'm in now as an office space. When my teenage boys have now taken it over, as only teenagers can. But I used to have a wall calendar, and I used to write my word count up, and it used to be next to me all the time. And that's very motivating. And then I moved it onto a spreadsheet, and there's just something about seeing the word count go up. And like I say to people, I always sit down with the best intentions to write 1,000 words. That's always my daily target, is 1,000 words a day. I always also have to caveat that with, obviously I've written quite a lot now, so that for me is manageable. For other people, I'm like, if 1,000 words sounds, like it makes you want to vomit, then do 500, do 300, but just give yourself something that you're aspiring to. But actually, if you don't hit it that day, it doesn't matter. It's just about getting your bum in the chair and showing up for yourself and saying to yourself, I am doing this, I'm taking this seriously. And just to see the word count go up, it is very motivating. The other sort of things I do is I have a little routine that gets my brain into writing mode, which I heard actually James Clear talking about recently, and he was saying about how obviously environment is so great for habit formation. Mm-hmm. And I have the same playlist that I use. I sit down at the same time every day, and I always put my phone on do not disturb. So I just have these little things that I do that when my brain hears that playlist now, it's like, oh, okay, we're writing.
Writing routine almost, yes, that you're establishing. And also, absolutely, I just have to say, it's worth, people should follow you definitely on Instagram, not only for the amazing hints, but also because you do share your playlists on there, which are very helpful as well.
Yeah, I think it's just showing people that there's a common misconception around writing that you have to sit for hours every day and you have to sit in silence, or you have to, some people say, I always think I have to book myself away somewhere for a week to write. And I think that is lovely. And if that is something that actually allows you to write, then by all means do that. But for a lot of business owners, myself included, I don't have 3 hours a day for writing. I have tops probably an hour, but mainly about half an hour. So I have this whole thing around writing for 30 minutes a day, and it's around the compound effect and the fact that if you write every day for 30 minutes for, if you can do 7 days, I do Monday to Friday because I view it as work, so I'm like, right, I'm in work mode. But I do 30 minutes, and I keep my spreadsheet, and I have my little writing routine, and the motivation comes, and I know there is science behind it, after you've done the thing. It doesn't come before. And actually, just by having that spreadsheet, sometimes before I start, then I just quickly glance at it and be like, oh, okay, so I'm up to whatever, 20,000 words. And I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, I'm about halfway through now. Good. Right. Okay. And it just gives me that little nudge to be like, we're doing this, we're okay, and there are some days where I don't write. And I split my days into sprints. So if I'm doing 1,000 words, and I might split it, if I've got a particularly busy day, I'll do 500 words in the morning, and then I'll do 500 like after lunch. And so again, I'm not making myself sit, and if I'm not feeling the vibe for hours and hours, I'm just like, I'm just gonna get these next 500 words done. That's what I'm thinking about. I'm not thinking about the 25,000 other words I have to write. I'm just thinking about the next 500 or the next 1,000, and then I'm like, right, banked that for today, on with the rest of the day. So yeah, I think that it's those little things, rather than trying to think of writing as this very big kind of thing that's going to take up hours of your time, because that is not appealing. And that's me as a writer, will say that to you.
So how about for you writing your books? Because it's 6 books you're up to now, right? With your latest one being Dare to Write.
Yeah.
So how long did it take you to do those? And did you find any of those particularly much easier than others, or more challenging than others?
The first one took a long time. Actually, bizarrely enough, is the one that sells the best in the teaching space. The reason it took the longest is because I went about it in the wrong way. So I was trying to write and edit as I went along, which is just a terrible idea. So, you know, I always say to people now, I never read back my first draft. I literally never look at what I did the day before, because otherwise I end up thinking, oh, I'll just quickly go to that paragraph. And then quickly is always half an hour later. So I think to myself, I just never, ever read anything until I get to the end. That's kind of the way that that helps me. And if I'd done that with the first one, I would have done it a lot quicker. Dare to Write was the easiest because it's what I do, bread and butter, for a living. I'm essentially telling people how to write a book. So it's the stuff I work with people on. So it was very quick to put together. And, you know, writing a book is a pretty linear process. So, you know, I wasn't having to think about, you know, putting things in, you know, a particular model in terms of like, you know, you could do this first, you could do this first. It's like, well, no, you need to plan it before, you know, and then write it and then edit it and then publish it, you know, so it's that kind of approach. Yeah. But also because I've written by this point, as I can say, like it's three children's novels, you know, that was five books up to that point. I blog for people. I have a blog myself. So by this point, I probably have written, I don't know, 500,000 words, something like that, even more. And so writing for me is now a very natural thing. But believe me, when I first did the first book in 2015, I was just like most of the people that I work with now, where I was like, well, I've got this idea that could help loads of teachers with their behavior management, but actually I don't know how to actually put that all down into a book. And but it's only through doing it and doing it and doing it, like anything, that you become better at it and more confident in what you're doing.
And when did you first start referring to yourself as a writer? Because I think people believe there's this certain point where you suddenly become a writer, much like, so I used to volunteer with This Mum Runs, which is an amazing organisation to get women particularly out and running. And we used to have so many conversations about at what point do you become a runner? Well, if you go for a run, you are a runner.
Agreed.
And the same is true for writing. People are really reluctant to claim I am a writer until they've got a book, or they've published a book, or their published book is best-selling, or their bestseller has been critically acclaimed. Or at what point do you feel, okay, I am now a writer?
I think I was probably pretty similar, actually. I don't think I said it until I'd had a few books, maybe the teaching books were out, and then I had a monthly column in a teaching magazine that came off the back of it. And I guess then I thought to myself, oh, actually, I probably should say that. And for a long time after I left teaching, I still used to call myself a teacher, which was really weird. People used to be like, oh, you know, and I used to be like, well, as a teacher, then I was thinking, well, it's been 3 years. I don't think I can hang my coattails on that anymore.
Yeah.
But to be fair, I mean, being a teacher has led me to have the skills that I can then teach other people how to write books. So, you know, it has been a roundabout way. I still am a teacher, just not in the same conventional way that I once was.
Yeah.
But it took me a long time to leave that label behind. And it was almost like I went through this process of being like, oh, I'm not a teacher anymore. Like, what is my identity?
Yeah.
And then I was like, actually, do you know what? I'm a writer, whether that in whatever capacity that is, I'm a writer. And I just started, and the more I used it, the more I said it, the more it became natural and part of the process of just introducing myself and talking about myself and also believing it myself. Because the more you say it, the more you're like, okay, yeah, you know, I feel in vibe with this. And that helped a lot.
I love that. I have a similar thing. So I've now left the NHS, but whenever I talk about the NHS, I very much call it a we. So
yeah.
About the NHS, and it's really hard to get out of the habit of, isn't it? Especially because, you know, it's been such a big part of you and you've been so very committed to it. It does form part of your identity. So that's really interesting to me. So we are rapidly running out of time, which is always scary because I always start these conversations and never really know where they'll go, and love them all. But I wanted to ask you about your clients, Steph, because I think it must be so incredibly satisfying. I know I get a big kick when people message me and say, as a result of this with you, I've now done this. And you just think that's amazing. And you have clients who, so let's go back right to the beginning. We talked about our mutual connection is Sarah Dalrymple, right? She has just written and released, and her book is available to buy from January, More Sales, Please. And you helped her through that process. Mm-hmm. How does it feel when one of your clients holds up their book and say, this is my book and it's real and it exists? How does that feel for you?
Yeah, it's such a joy. And I think I feel such pride and pride for them. Like, I'm just so proud of them because I know the journey they've been on. I know how much they've doubted maybe themselves through the process, like we all do, you know, particularly when you're in the middle and you're like, is any of this making any sense? And I just, it's such a privilege, honestly. I know that sound, people might think, oh, you sound like a bit of a dick, but you know, it's such a privilege to support people with something like this, because to see them with the finished copy, to see them on the shelf in a bookshop, like, I feel like, you know, it just fills me with joy. I honestly, there's nothing I would love to be able to, and as a writer, this is kind of weird, find the words to say it, but it's such a joy to see, because I know the journey that's got them to that point, but also, like, good for you. That's what I just want to say. Good for you. Like, good for getting your stuff out there, telling people about your being an expert. And that's why I want more women to do the writing thing, because we're very underrepresented in the nonfiction and business book space, right? It's predominantly been a male dominated field, where, you know, there was some research done recently from a new prize that's come out called the Women's Nonfiction Prize, and they did some research about why it's so poorly represented in the female space. Mm-hmm. And they were saying that basically, over history, women have been told to leave the big stuff to the men when it comes to writing. And it's like, you know, the big topics need to be written by men. And, you know, lots of people have said, oh, yes, because obviously more women write memoir and more sort of like the kind of the gentler topics. I don't even know what that would even look like. But the gentler topics are, it's okay for a woman to do. But for men, if we want stuff, you know, that's really means something and is going to move like society forward, it needs to be a man. And it drives me absolutely mad, because there are so many women with incredible expertise, like Sarah, who has a vast experience in the sales space and is helping so many women to make more money in their business. Why the hell is she not being listened to by a wider community? And, you know, a book is a great way to kind of give her that sort of next level authority, where she's like, I've written this down in this book, and, you know, it's helping X amount of people. So yeah, I'm thrilled, and I adore her, and I adore all my clients, because I just think, good for you, you know, get yourself out there, start making noise in your space. And that's what it's all about.
Amazing. What couple of top hints and tips would you have if people are listening to this and now thinking, bloody hell, I'm going to write that book? What are the hints and tips you might share with them to really start on that process?
I think the first thing is to really think about the reader. And I know that sounds, when you're thinking about writing, you think about yourself and what your knowledge is and your expertise, and they all will come into it. They will. But essentially, books are for readers. Okay, they're not for the writer who wrote them. They are for the reader, because the reader is egocentric. They're thinking about their own problem, their own issue. So the starting point for anybody is to be like, who's my reader, and what the hell is the matter with them? Because in nonfiction and business book space, we reach for books for advice, for knowledge, to upskill ourselves. So you need to think, right, where are they at emotionally? Like, why are they picking my book up off a shelf? What's causing them to do that? What are they searching for answers for? And that can really start to get your ideas flowing. So you might have a kernel of an idea for what you want your book to be about, but then it's like, okay, let me think about the person reading this. Like, what is it that they want from this experience of reading? Because we have to remember now, obviously more than ever, our attention spans have decreased, and also less people are, you know, whereas once the book was the obvious choice for entertainment and for knowledge, now we've obviously battling with social media, the internet, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So you've got to think about the reader. You've got to make them feel like they have to read your book, not that it'll be, oh, that'd be quite nice to read one day. It's like, what are they going to be like? I've got to read this. This is going to help me. So think of the reader. And then, you know, if you're at that point where you're like, yeah, know my reader, I kind of know what their issue is, I know what I want my book to be about, it's then just really, I just brain dump all of my ideas about that particular topic onto a large bit of paper, and I pin it up somewhere, and I just leave it up, and I come back to it. And just for the next week or so, I just leave it there, and I let my brain do the work, because it'll be when I'm brushing my teeth, or I'm walking my dog, or I'm doing something where, you know, all of a sudden I'm like, oh yes, I want to talk about that. And I go scribble it down on the sheet and then I go away again. And I just allow that to be there to keep the creative process going in my subconscious and just to remind me of like things that I might want to include. And then when I've got that ready, then I start to kind of map it out into chapters. But yeah. Just...
That's like that brain percolation. Just
yes.
Because it is, it's when you're in the shower or you've gone for a walk or you're in the supermarket or whatever it might be. Suddenly you think, oh my goodness, that would link with that.
Yeah, really. I have so many notes on my notes app on my phone where I've been walking and I've been like, oh, that's a good character name for someone in a novel, or, oh, I want to talk about that. And they're just literally all these random that I'll then go and transfer to, you know, the bigger sheet you know, but I like to be around the big sheet quite a lot because I just think it just keeps me thinking about it. And ticking things over.
It's like a vision board, isn't it? You know, when you have a vision board and I brush my teeth quite often in front of my vision board. And I can imagine, I've now got an image of you brushing your teeth in front of your big picture book idea board as well, which is
No, it does work. It does work.
Brilliant. Steph, we are drawing to a close, which always annoys me. But there is one question that I always ask each of my podcast guests. And so you are no different, my friend. I am going to ask you, what advice would you give your 21-year-old self?
Yeah, I thought about this. And actually, I think it's just about being comfortable in who you are and not following the trends, because I think for a lot of my early life I thought did what I thought I should, you know. So I went into teaching, you know, I enjoyed it, but it, you know, I never really thought about, well, what do I want out of life, what do I want to achieve, and what do I really love doing. And I think I'd say that to my 21-year-old self, even if other people will be absolutely confused by your life choices, that's okay, because it's not their life, it's yours. And I think we often do that. We make decisions where we think, what will other people think? What will my family think? And actually, you know, you don't want to get to the end of your life. You know, I was listening to Bronnie Ware on Feel Better, Live More recently, and she's the palliative care nurse who did the end of life, 5 Regrets of the Dying. Yeah. And she said, the top regret is I wish I had done what made me happy. And I often think about that. And I often think, if I get to the end of my life and I look back and I've not written that novel that I've been thinking about, or I didn't do, you know, what I didn't do, go to this particular place, you know, you just don't do them because you think, oh, I'll do it one day and I'll do it one day. And we don't know when is the last day. So I always think, my 21-year-old self, just bloody go and do what makes you happy.
Oh my goodness, what an amazing point to draw our conversation to a close. But before we head off, I'm going to ask you to let people know where they can find you, Steph, because if they're anything like me, they will have been motivated the hell out of this morning and will be putting up their book percolation sheet and be trying to find you to find out more about how they can bring this into being. So where can they find you, Steph?
So I am on Instagram at Creating Happy Writers, and I am on LinkedIn because lots of business people are there who've got ideas for books. So if you're there, do come and find me. And yeah, it's just at stephcaswell.com. And like I said, Dare to Write is the book that you need if you are thinking of writing a book, because it takes you right from the initial idea all the way through to publication. So it will give you a nice roadmap of what the journey looks like.
Absolutely. And we'll make sure we put the links to all of those, including that valuable book, in the show notes. Steph, it has been a joy, a pleasure, an honour, and really quite inspiring to hang out with you this morning. Once I finish recording this, I'm going to try and get my 1,000 words done for today. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What an amazing conversation, and what great advice at the end. Did that work for you, I wonder? I'd love to hear from you if you have been inspired by this podcast to go from dreaming about writing a book into creating it into reality. I know Steph would want to hear about that as well, so do reach out. All of the information you need is in the show notes. And I'm going to leave you with this thought that you don't have to be producing or publishing something to consider yourself to be a writer or an artist of any sort. Like the running, if you run, you are a runner. If you're creating, you are a creative. I will take some of my own medicine too. Until next time, take good care, and I'll see you soon. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast from Inside the Hive by Quiet the Hive, then please leave us a 5-star rating or drop us any comments in the box below. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Any comments or ratings you give us all help other people who would benefit from the content to find us. Thanks so much.